Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on KHOI Radio. Hi, welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
And I'd like to welcome Donna back from a long, long hiatus. She spent a good amount of time on the other side of the world. So I welcome Donna back, and we're looking forward to a whole new summer of good stuff. We are on a new day of the week now. Tuesdays at noon. Find us at KHOI Radio. Tuesdays at noon, and also will be repeated 7 o'clock at night. So welcome.
On Tuesdays.
So welcome back to Donna. So tell us a little bit about your great adventure in New Zealand.
Well, what I always say about New Zealand is it's clean, 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 clean. The water is clean. The rivers are clean. The ocean is clean. I don't know, just mean neat and tidy. They are neat and tidy because they're kind of very English-like down there. But the environment is much cleaner there than it is here. And that was a thrill for me because I have chemical sensitivities and I felt really healthy down there. So that was the great thing. The difficult things are that they're not that sophisticated in their eating habits. They still eat a lot of very English fish and chips, not very many vegetables, a lot of meats and potatoes. Kind of, it's a lot like Iowa maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Opposite seasons. So down there, it was the fall. And the farmers' market should have been full of produce. So they had a few tomatoes, nothing really good. The whole 3 months I was there, I finally ate one really good tomato. And we're talking like what it would be in September here. That was very disappointing. They have lots of room to change that up, however, because they really have a marvelous climate. And all the beef and the milk and the sheep are all grass-fed, so it's quite delicious.
I picture New Zealand as this wonderful little island with kind of laid-back, friendly people, and I picture green, with surrounded by oceans.
Very accurate.
Yeah, you talked about citrus. Of course, the seasons are different, so it's this kind of climate that you can have citrus and lots of fruit trees?
Oh, yeah. Well, the part of the island where my daughter and grandson live, which is kind of the middle of the North Island, is very like Southern California, only much greener and much cleaner. So around there, there's lots of citrus. Also, of course, lots of apple trees and the possibilities for growing year-round, which I don't think they make quite enough of. My favorite New Zealand flavors are passion fruit, and then what we call guava, they call feijoa. So those are kind of my New Zealand flavors.
Oh, feijoa with a J?
F-I-J?
Fidge, okay.
Feijoa.
Oh, that's good. What's that? That must maybe it's a Maori word. Who knows? That's good.
I don't know.
Good. You mentioned, and I've heard this in reference to New Zealand before, that it is sort of like 10, 20 years, like Iowa was 10 or 20 years ago. So is the cleanliness and the environmental quality just because they haven't had a chance to screw it up, or do they realize they have to take care? Are things being done to take care down
there?
Well,
I think they realize, because most of the people there are immigrants. And so they're either two or three generations there by choice. And I think they realize the preciousness of living in a South Pacific island. And, of course, the population of the whole country of New Zealand is about the same as the population of Iowa. So there's vast tracts of, really natural land. And, of course, the Maoris have their own land, which they are very careful to preserve in a natural state and a lot of reverence for land, which rubs off on all of the other settlers. So, of course, they're not perfect. They are moving towards probably some disruptive things. They have way too much dairy, even though it is all grazed. That's their thing. And their main exports are, of course, beef, dairy, and pine forest kind of thing.
That sounds good. Well, I'm sorry to hear that you didn't eat very many good tomatoes down there, or have any luck with tomato sauce either.
Oh, no. They have ketchup, but it's not like American ketchup. So my grandson is not very happy about that. He has to have American ketchup. Their ketchup, I liked it, though. They add more clove than we are used to here.
Oh, a whole different thing. A whole different thing.
And they're just getting into Mexican food. There's now a few Mexican restaurants, but nothing to our standards.
Okay, good. Well, maybe if you go down there again, you can teach them a few things. That's good. Well, a few words about tomatoes, as in lack of, down under, and we are moving into spring and planting season. If you are looking for tomatoes, plant lots. You can always give them away. There's food banks, there's neighbors you can give them to or share them with people. A few planting tips for tomatoes. I sell tomato seedlings. And often people come back to me with their dead little seedling. And the very first thing that I want to tell you, do not overwater in those little pots that you buy from a greenhouse. Or the roots are busy growing, but a little plastic pot is really easy to overwater. Once you put it in the ground, the roots can really go wild. So then you can water. That's fine. That's the main thing that I notice that people have a challenge with. Also, I want to mention a few favorite varieties, and these are pretty well, you can get them pretty much any place. Castelluto, Brandywine, San Marzano are classic tomatoes to make sauce out of, kind of all-purpose things. Also, I grow one, and you can probably find it elsewhere. It's called a piriforma. It's a large red pear. Ugly tomato if you go by traditional tomato standards. It's skinny, pointy at the top, big fat at the bottom. It's a big beefsteaky kind of thing. That's a lovely thing. It's a lovely thing. And don't be afraid of the fact that not all tomatoes are red. There's black ones, there's green ones, there's yellow ones, there's pink ones. There's orange ones. Taste them all. They're all lovely. Good.
And are all yellow tomatoes low acid?
Not all yellow tomatoes are, but they tend that way. You can find low acid tomatoes that are yellow, orange. It will say on the variety description.
Uh-huh.
Some of them are. Some of them really are. So if you have trouble with tomatoes being a little too hard on your stomach or hard on your cold sores, perhaps. Yeah, you can look for those kind of tomatoes. I want to mention one kind. Everyone loves the Sun Gold tomatoes. That is not a heirloom tomato. That is a hybrid tomato. And I also would recommend something called Fargo Yellow Pear. Yellow pear tomatoes never used to be my favorite, but that's a variety I'm kind of pushing this because I like that one. That's good.
Is it a small one or a full-sized one?
It is a small.
Is it cherry?
It's a cherry kind.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's a plant it in your garden and go out and harvest and eat as you go. That's a good way to eat tomatoes. Okay, next.
Oh, basil. Basil, basil, basil. Time to put the basil in. You want to talk about varieties?
Not so much. Again, basil is not always green. There's big leaf green. There's small leaf green. There's
globe basil, which is teeny weeny.
Teeny tiny.
I love those.
Yeah, there's the kind that grow very well in a pot to keep on your windowsill or on your deck. Those work well. And then there's a huge variety of colored basils, many purples. And they have a slightly different flavor. Go ahead and taste them.
Oh, like opal basil? Isn't that the one you use in your apple jelly that makes it such a pretty color?
Yeah. There's a couple different kinds of basils, purple basils. There's a Thai basil.
Love Thai basil.
Yeah. So be aware that there's lots out
Lemon
there.
Lemon basil, cinnamon basil.
Yes. And they're all lovely.
And I like to plant multiple plants, not just because it takes quite a lot of basil to make pesto, But also, I like to dry my own basil. It's one of the easiest things you can do. You can dry it all summer long, but usually I wait in the fall just before the frost, and I run out in the garden and I grab everything that's left. I tie them together with twine and hang them upside down in my window, because dried basil that you have dried yourself is so much more flavorful than anything you could possibly buy. So I highly recommend, I always try to do at least Thai basil and regular basil.
Because there is a difference in the taste. And also, after your basil is dried, store it in an airtight jar away from the light. Yes. That's what I've heard, and it does help if it's not if it's not sitting in the sun.
And also, I hang it in the window to dry until it's kind of starting to fall off the plant. So then I take a newspaper and I strip it very gently onto the paper, because you want to leave the leaves intact as much as you can, because the more you crush them, the more the volatile oils are released. So if you pack them lightly in the jar and kind of keep them as whole as you can.
Yes, and then when you're ready to cook, then's the time for crumbling them up.
Yeah, then you just kind of roll them in your hands and drop them into the pot.
Good. Well, we come to the point of the show that I'm going to call Snake. I have a story from Onion Creek Farm that I would like to share. I had a visit from my neighbor Diane and her daughter Morgan. They came to visit me Sunday afternoon. They knocked on my door, opened my door, and here I see these two wonderful women standing there with big, wide eyes looking straight at me, and both of their right hands were pointing to the roof of my porch off to the right. And I looked slowly off to the corner, and up in the rafters, actually as pretty as you can be, was a very large snake wrapped around all the little pegs that I hang garden tools on. So it couldn't have been prettier. I mean, if I was staging something.
And this picturesque snake.
And this snake, obviously, they shed. So this had recently shed because its skin was glossy, lovely. And because my neighbor works at ISU in connection with, Animal Extension, I do believe, she immediately said, "That is a fox snake." Ah. And so we identified it and commented each other.
Tell me how long you think it
was.
Oh,
my goodness. I'm holding my arms out as far as I can reach.
That looks like 4 feet or something.
It was, because it went up and down and up and down. It was a long, long thing. And it was, as I got out the Snakes of Iowa DNR publication and identified it. That, as far as I know, it was a fox snake. I have two reactions to snakes. My first reaction is, snake! And then my second reaction is, remember, there are no poisonous snakes in central Iowa. I say that to myself over and over again. Then I back up and realize how absolutely lovely they are. They are a companion in the garden. We see them all summer and see them in the woods. And occasionally, I even see them wrapped around some of my flower pots. And in the fall, they do try to get into the house. But they're also really good mousers. Remember, snake, and there are no poisonous snakes in central Iowa. So snakes are our friends.
Well, I have a little snake story to tell. Maybe 10 or 15 years ago, when I was doing belly dancing and living in Los Angeles, the teacher kept pythons. She had a pair of them. So one particular class, she set all the women in a circle on the floor, and she got the pythons out and let us have them crawl all over us. It was the most sensual feeling. They were probably, maybe 3 to 4 inches in diameter and quite long, and they moved so luxuriantly. And I just can't describe the sensation. It was thrilling, just thrilling. And you think of all of the ancient symbols with snakes, like for Kundalini and the Ouroboros, which is the snake eating its tail, and on the medical sign of the Caduceus. They are all symbols of life force. So a snake in the spring, I think that's a good omen.
I think
very
so, too.
Good.
It's a good thing, snakes, yes. Also, I want to mention, last Saturday at the Donna Lana Kitchen, Donna and I were at the Ames Farmers Market, and I want to thank everybody that came and said hello to us And we'll be looking forward to seeing you again, probably this next coming week. We have some plans for more summer shows. We're going to be on every week, as I said, on Tuesday noon. So find us here.
Yeah, and we'll be letting you know what's perfectly local in season, places to find it, how to grow it, how to cook it, and any other extraordinary food news that we can come up with.
Most definitely. I think we'll take a little break here. A little Hammer Dulcimer music. The Dill Pickle Rag.
I want you all to know that Lana picked this music, and she herself plays the hammer dulcimer.
Not that fancy, though. That was the Dill Pickle Rag by a musician named Tom McKenzie. He was traveling through Iowa and stayed with us. So that's good. That's good. We wanted to mention again that we were at the Ames Main
Downtown.
Street.
Downtown.
Ames Main Street Farmers Market last weekend.
Because we have multiple farmers markets.
Yes, we do. And in future shows, we'll be giving you updates on all sorts of green and growing things and things happening at Farmers Market around central Iowa. So it's spring. What's up? What are some seasonal treats here that we can look forward to?
Well, obviously, asparagus, quick while it lasts.
Yes, that's true. I don't know. We may be a kind of on the tail end of asparagus. I'm not sure.
I hope not, because I haven't had my fill yet.
It's hard to get your fill. One of the joys of eating fresh and eating local is eating your fill of things.
Yeah, saturate your appetite while you have the opportunity. In terms of cooking, I think the most important thing for asparagus is not to overcook it. Well, there are two things. How to clean it. You know, there's this thing where you kind of wiggle along the stem, and where it's ready to snap is where you break it.
You mean on the fat end?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So that you can eat as much of it as is possibly tender. Mm-hmm. It's a very tactile experience. Mm-hmm. And each spear is individually unique.
Oh, my.
So don't just, like, whack it with a knife. You may lose a lot of good asparagus that way. The other thing is not cooking it too long. Most people steam it, and then the usual culinary trick is to blanch it in cold water immediately so you stop the cooking, and that keeps it, you know, with a little snap to it in your teeth. The other way to do it that I really like is to put a little olive oil on a cookie sheet, line them all up, roll them around, and then have your oven very hot, like 450, and then you broil them very quickly, much quicker than you think. That's how I always do it. And don't forget what you're doing. Then I take them out immediately, and I roll them off the hot pan onto the counter and spread them out so that they cook very quickly.
great.
And the easiest way to do that is after you've roasted them like that is to take a lemon and just zest, not juice, just zest, salt, pepper, and lemon zest. They're also good with lemon, of course, but the zest is even subtler. But there are many ways to eat asparagus, and I encourage you to have all of them.
Yay. Sounds good.
We also have rhubarb at the market, mm-hmm. and probably will for at least another month or two,
yes.
I suppose. I have a gardening question, Lana. My rhubarb doesn't have red stalks like yours.
There are a couple of different varieties of rhubarb, and I cannot remember the names of varieties, but you can get red-stalked ones, you can get green-stalked ones. And really, close your eyes. They both taste like rhubarb, but the red ones make prettier sauce. So
they do. Yeah. And somehow I seem to have about four plants that are the green kind. So when I cook them, I usually add something red.
Mm-hmm.
Not red food coloring, of course, but like maybe a little cranberry juice or something to make it perk up to that red color that we like in rhubarb.
Oh, that's great. Also at the market we found turnips and cabbage. There were some strawberries at market. Would you believe it? There's some hoop house strawberries, and there was, I believe, some hoop house salad greens because things were really lovely. You said you found some
baby mizuma.
Oh, my goodness. So all that kind of stuff is looking good. Gardens are showing promise all over. There's garlic, onions, leeks, peas, lettuce. All kinds of stuff is coming up. Horseradish is up. Horseradish.
My horseradish plants are so beautiful. I have to say, even when there's a drought, the horseradish plants look really lush. And I don't often even harvest them. You can, oh, like today, they have a nice little white flowers. Mm-hmm. So I picked some for bouquet, and the leaves are quite good for salads.
Mm-hmm. I've had mm-hmm. horseradish leaf too. It has a little bit of subtle kick to
yeah,
it,
it's but good.
It's
little,
not strong. Little, it's not strong.
Yeah.
It's
and
not
then
strong.
We did make horseradish root last fall, and this fall we'll probably, I think we talked about it on the show, we'll talk about it again.
Yeah.
There's so much going on in the garden, and I don't know why we celebrate. I guess just because the relief of the spring green gets you out there. I've been collecting salads of course, all of the, particularly the young, small dandelion leaves, the horseradish leaves. My lovage has gone gangbusters, so I've been throwing that in the salad. And then I have lots of wild garlic, and my, I suppose it's almost a noxious weed in Iowa, but eat it. It's so good for you.
And the garlic chives, too.
Mm-hmm.
Parsley is coming up. Sorrel's coming up. Gangbusters, if you have a plant. That is a perennial. It does get a little root bound. You do have to divide it every now and then or start it from seed. You can get things in the wild, too.
Oh,
violet greens are
yes.
good. Lamb's quarters are good. It's coming. And we're going to talk a little bit about
nettles, because we get a lot of them around here. Now, of course, you know they are stinging nettles, which means you got to pick them with gloves, and they will be stinging. I don't trust them until I've actually blanched them. But people say to use it like spinach. Well, because it does cook down, like anything you would put spinach in, you can put nettles in. However, the flavor is not like spinach. I think the flavor is more really like collards without the toughness.
Huh.
It just tastes really green.
And once you cook it, they're not quite so picky, stingy.
No, as soon as it's cooked, it's fine. I'm going to just read a little bit about nettles from Rosemary Gladstar, who's a fantastic herbalist. The book's called Family Herbal. She says the benefits. This is the stinging nettle that farmers despise, hikers hate, and children learn to avoid. But herbalists around the world fall at the feet of this green goddess, green man herb. I'm convinced it is one of the superior tonic herbs and is as important as many of the famous Chinese long lifers. Herbs. It is a vitamin factory rich in iron, calcium, potassium, silicone, magnesium, manganese, zinc, chromium, as well as a host of other vitamins and minerals. One of my favorite all-round remedies, it makes a great hair and scalp tonic. It activates the metabolism by strengthening and toning the entire system. It's quite a recommendation. Then she has a little sidebar called Nettles Through the Seasons. The tips of the nettle plant in early spring, now, and summer are superior, though I've eaten them throughout the season. If you have a stand of nettles nearby, it's a good practice to trim them constantly throughout the season so they'll keep producing those tasty tops until fall. So go nettles, guys. It's our, you know, it's the premium opportunity for the internal spring cleaning.
Ooh, sounds good. Sounds good. I want to remind everyone you're listening to KHOI Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen with Donna and Lana. Oh, Lovage, let's tell the audience a little bit more about Lovage. People are familiar with chives. They're familiar with parsley. Tell us what Lovage is.
Lovage is an old herb that's sort of celery-like in flavor. It has big green leaves. It also dries extremely well. And it's a good idea to dry your own lovage because if you want to try and buy it, you will never find it. It goes great with tomato, especially cooked tomato plants, any tomato soup I put it in. It goes well with everything. I throw it in stir fries right now. I've just been chopping it into salads.
Any recipe that you would think would benefit from celery, that sort of clean, up-in-the-nose kind of taste.
Yeah, but it's more herbaceous than celery. It's it's really, I cannot understand why people don't use it more. It's an old herb. It grows easily and beautifully here. It is a perennial, hallelujah. Comes up early, stays late.
Grows amazingly well here in Iowa. It may get like 2 feet tall, and it looks like a giant flat-leaf parsley plant on steroids is what it looks like. And it's good to keep it picked. It does eventually set up a flower late in the season. Pick that flower off as you're using it because it keeps then the green stuff keeps coming. Oh, let's see. Oh, here's a little history of Lovage. Lovage is a handsome plant with a powerful flavor and numerous uses, both traditional and modern. Its leaves used to be laid in shoes to revive the weary traveler. And at inns, it was served as a popular cordial, flavored also with tansy and yarrow. So a modern form of this cordial is made by steeping Lovage seeds in brandy and sugar. So
Lovage seeds in brandy and sugar.
That's what it says. And it will settle an upset stomach. Well, yeah, I believe that. That's good. That's good. That's good.
I like it in coleslaw, too.
Okay, we'll take a little break here. Have some music. With some good accordion music, an old-fashioned button accordion, matter of fact. Accordion tune by Dwight Lamb from his CD called Danish and American Melodies. He's a A Midwestern treasure. He also teaches fiddlers here in the Midwest. Dwight Lamb is from Missouri. And that tune was called The Crested Hen, a traditional Danish dance tune. The Crested Hen. So a few words about chickens. To all of you who have a backyard flock and to those that are raising chicks this time of year, good speed and good health to all those little chicks. Mine are sort of moving from the cute and fuzzy stage to the awkward adolescent stage. It's a progress. And they're starting to be a little naughty, but that's all right. They're turning into a nice little flock, and I hope everybody's chicken flock is doing quite well out there. Also, I have some chicken garden helpers this time of year. I've got a couple old hens that join me in the garden, and I never know they're there until I turn over a forkful or a spadeful of garden dirt, and I've got this white leghorn and an Araucana that are right at my feet. They practically ride the shovel. They are looking for bugs, and they suck up those worms and everything. It's good. They're joining me. I enjoy them.
Pet chickens.
Yeah, they're good. They're good. They're good. So I have a little news item here. I found this in the Ames paper. The Ames Tribune. A couple weeks ago. It's from an article. The writer was Gavin Arison, staff writer. And this was on the front page of the paper. And I saw it and I read it and I thought, oh, this has got to be like, this is an April Fool's joke, right? No. Looking into this, there is a design professor.
At ISU.
At ISU. And he does what good art does. It challenges us to think. And he has a proposal here. The article is called, ISU Design Professor Envisions Virtual Reality Lives for Farm Animals. I'll read the first few paragraphs here. Could chickens raised in close confinement live more humane lives if they experienced them virtually? That's a question posed by Austin Stewart, an assistant professor in Iowa State University's College of Design, for his latest project. He calls it Second Livestock, a takeoff on the popular online virtual world, Second Life. The idea goes something like this. Chickens, too numerous in the United States to realistically all live free-range lives, could be raised in cages more humanely if from a young age they stood on omnidirectional treadmills and wore virtual reality headsets, displaying three-dimensional worlds mapped to their feet and scratch, mimicking a free-range existence. Such a life would also provide protection from stressors and predators that threaten free-range chickens. Quote from Austin Stewart here. The goal of this project is to raise that question of how do we know what's best? What's humane treatment? And also to look at how we treat ourselves. We're living in these little boxes just like chickens. So that was from the Ames Tribune. Oh, thank you, Donna. That was lovely. And there's a picture of here. I assume it's an artist's conception of a chicken wearing virtual glasses. And it really, it does what.
Aren't we creative here in Ames? Oh
does,
boy!
It does what good art does. It makes us think. Austin Stewart was part of an art event here in Ames in the end of April. It was called Art Vacancy, and it was a kind of a guerrilla art taking over empty storefronts in downtown Ames. Thanks to Lindsay Nissen for putting this event together. That was lovely. He was part of the event along with many others. So we'll keep our eyes open.
I hope we have another one. We can pre-announce it so
yes,
we can all make the rounds here.
So think about virtual livestock, yes or no?
Now, Lana told me, I said, what is Joe, her partner, doing today? He's out on the tractor.
Out the tractor. Yes. Now's the time of year that you go to the shed and you need all that stuff. And I hope everybody out there finds all their parts. To all those people out there who are dealing with power takeoffs and cotter pins, coulter bars and harrows and things that break, but they need to work this time of year. I have a poem here, a poem by a poet named Joyce Stufen. It's from a book called Good Poems, edited by Garrison Keillor. I mean, what's not to
How
like?
How reliable.
It's what's not to like. This whole bunch of section on working and working on the farm. This poem is called Girl on a Tractor. Oh, and this is a shout-out to Tabletop Farm. They have a new tractor this year. So
and a good girl on that new
good
tractor.
Good girl on that
Sally
tractor.
Sally Grand.
Yes. So good luck with your new John Deere, and I hope you have all the parts connected up like you're supposed to. Here's the tractor poem. It's called Girl on a Tractor by Joyce Stufen. I knew the names of all the cows before I knew my alphabet. But no matter the subject, I had mastery of it. And when it came time to help in the fields, I learned to drive a tractor at just the right speed so that two men, walking on either side of the moving wagon, could lift each bale, walk towards the steady arriving platform, and simultaneously hoist the bale onto the rack, walk to the next bale, lift, turn and find me there, exactly where I should be, my hand on the throttle, carefully measuring out the pace.
Tractor dancing.
Tractor dancing. Ha. There we have it. So good luck to all the field work going on now. Speed the plow, yes. All right. I have a question. I am growing for the first time in many years, something called epazote. It's an herb, and I was going to ask Donna what she knew about epazote.
Well, epazote is very traditional in Mexican cooking, and I know from my California living days, Southern California, it grows wild. It just pops up in the yard like a weed, and it run out, pluck it, throw it in the pot. So I'm sure it just kind of randomly comes up all over Mexico. It's for cooking with beans. Now, it smells and tastes rather strange. It's not something you think you would love, but boy, when you put it in that bean pot, it really works with the earthiness of beans. And supposedly, it's to cut the gassiness of beans. And it does dry well, too, just like the lovage and the basil that we were talking about. So I am going to grow quite a bit of it, of Lana's plants, and have some to dry, because that also is hard to find when you want to cook. But throw it in all of your bean pots. You will never, ever regret it.
Oh, beans and regret, two words that go together. So let's put epazote in our lives. Yes.
That is spelled E-P-A-Z-O-T-E, epazote.
Epazote, good. The plant, it grows actually pretty well from seed, so find epazote seed and you can plant that. And I have heard that it self-seeds. It will not, it freezes out, of course, over the winter. It's an annual.
In this climate.
Yeah. It's an annual or short-lived perennial plant. So if it comes back, it'll be coming back from seeds. The flowers are small and green, and they have a branched, it looks sort of like a cannabis leaf, sort of. It has very irregular.
I think it also looks like a skinny catnip.
Skinny catnip, kind of pointy leaf.
And it has that kind of catnippy smell-like to it. So even though you think you won't like it, try it. Just throw it in the pot of beans. It's not something I would chop into a salad, for example, or anything, but heavier, that earthy kind of food. It's very good in that.
It's a cooking thing. It's a cooking thing. It's also called worm seed, Wikipedia here.
Didn't know that.
It's called Jesuit tea, Mexican tea. But epazote is a nice word. Put that in your pot and boil it for a while. So that's good. Epazote. And speaking of aromatic things, when I think of herbs, I think of things that smell. Tell me about rose geraniums.
Rose geranium. There are scented geraniums, lots of scents, chocolate, mint, orange, and rose, and there are multiple rose geraniums, but Lana has my favorite, which I have always known as skeleton rose geranium. I have several plants of it. I bring it in every winter, along with my lemon verbena, because they don't overwinter, and I always love them in the garden. So what do I do with rose geranium? You can dry it, but I like to just pick it. And, for example, the favorite thing is rose geranium whipped cream. So you take your whipping cream and you simmer it lightly with some rose geranium leaves in it, and then you chill it with the leaves in it. Then you, I usually just pick them up and squeeze them to get as much juice out of it as I can into the whipped cream just before I whip it. Of course, you know, you have to whip it chilled. And then you just season it with vanilla or not, and sugar as usual, and it makes a delightful kind of antique floral flavor for whatever you're going to put the whipped cream on. I also put it in jams and jellies, tart ones like plum, strawberry. You can make a rose geranium syrup, which is just boiling it in lemon water. I mean, not lemon water, sugar water.
I highly recommend that on vanilla ice cream. I have tried that in the
past. Yes. It's very versatile. I think the traditional ways of using it were, for example, if you were baking a pound cake, you would put some rose geranium leaves in the bottom of the pan, then bake the pound cake, and then when you invert it, you've got the leaves on the top. Another thing people used to do is pack sugar with it. I've done that, but my sugar got pretty lumpy, you know, from the...
Oh, there'd be moisture.
Yeah, so, yeah. Exactly. So then I kind of had to grind it back down again, but that's another way of preserving that flavor. I would also think it'd be wonderful for sachets in your underwear drawer and things like that. You know, it's a delicious and one of my favorite. I think the thing that's most common around here is, what's that one that they call the mosquito plant? It is a scented geranium.
There's one that is a rose, well, a rose peppermint scent. I've got a list of Latin names here, but it doesn't do anybody good.
Well, I don't cook with the one that they call the mosquito plant, but it is a scented geranium, and they are technically not in the geranium family, so they're not geraniums. They do have tiny little flowers, but really it's the flavoring that's the interesting part of it. And they're pretty in the garden, too.
Right. Good. So think of not only a plant that smells good, but play around with
you can tasting cook with it.
Another thing that smells, sweet woodruff, May wine.
Oh, this one, I'm going to read you a little bit about this one. My friend Carolyn Raffensperger has a whole bunch of it around her house, and she turned me on to this. This is the way Carolyn and I do it, which I think is pretty traditional. You take a white, it's German, so we were using white German wines like a Riesling or something, and this is only good in the spring, and you drop a few leaves into the wine and let it sit a little bit, and then when you go to drink the wine, it smells like a fresh hay field. It's really, really lovely. I'm going to read a bit about sweet woodruff from a book called The Drunken Botanist. The subtitle is Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. I recommend this as a reference and for reading. She's very entertaining. So she's talking about herbs that go into alcohol. And this one is called, it says, sweet woodruff. This low-growing perennial plant puts out beautiful star-shaped leaves, and in spring, even smaller white star-shaped flowers. Although it could easily be overlooked as an insignificant, shade-loving woodland ground cover, it gives off a sweet, grassy fragrance, which is an indicator that it contains high levels of potentially toxic coumarin. For this reason, the plant is not considered a safe food additive in the United States, except for flavoring in alcohol beverages. Here we go. Sweet woodruff is a traditional ingredient in May wine, or Mat wine. My wine, I guess. Pardon my German. A German traditional I can't say this word. Aromatized. There we go. Sorry about that tongue. Aromatized wine made by infusing the wine with sprigs of woodruff in early spring before the coumarin levels in the plant have come to dangerous levels. It is often served with fruit at May Day festivals. So here we are in May with the sweet woodruff.
Oh, yes. I want to mention a little bit about what sweet woodruff looks like. The leaves look like little umbrellas.
Upside down.
So imagine,
and it's tiny.
Tiny. Imagine if you opened up little green umbrellas and stacked in decreasing order from bottom is biggest to the little on the top, stacked these open umbrellas on top of one another.
And that's sort of what the sweet woodruff leaves
right,
look
and
like.
It's maybe only, I mean, I've never seen it more than 4 or 5 inches high, and mm-hmm. it grows in the shade. And it is, I think, pretty much we have it around in random spots yeah. around here.
Semi-shade, prefers moist, porous loam, but will survive on less rich soil. It's something to find around. And look for those little white leaves. So, May wine.
Well, speaking of what's found in random places around here, tell us about morel mushrooms.
Ah, the morel report. For the past few weeks, I've been asking friends and neighbors, have you found any? And it wasn't until yesterday that I found some. The weather
It
was too cold. The weather was just about right. I'm sure other people had a little hidey hole someplace, but I happened to find a really nice mess, as they say, of them. Of them in the woods in front of my house. And also I found some more this morning, because that's one of the tricks. Morels are fleeting and ethereal. If you find some, go back.
So this is a hint. We've had a few days of warm weather. Get out there. It's now.
Yes, get out there and look. Tell us about cooking these wonderful things.
Well, they're so rare and so delicate. The first thing you have to think about is cleaning them. Don't wash them.
No.
You use a very delicate finger brush on them. There are mushroom brushes. You just brush the dirt off, and then I just saute them in butter. And whatever you want to put them in, it needs to be like eggs or something very bland so you really get the full flavor of the mushroom.
Right. And
don't cook them too long either.
And here's my hint. Not that I'm a great morel hunter. I find enough for supper. I don't find enough to make myself rich. Every year. Every year I look for a standing dead elm tree. And this is something you have to learn. Find what an elm tree looks like. A standing dead elm tree. And also, learn to develop a sense of place so you know where these places are. A sense of place is a really nice thing to have. And then also sense of place, work on your senses. You look really hard. It's down there among the wild ginger. It's among the violets. It's among the rue anemones and trout lilies and bluebells that are out this time of year.
And I was at Lana's yesterday, and she has purple violets, purple and white violets, and yellow violets.
That's good. Mention ramps. I found ramps.
Oh,
too.
Yes. She had ramps yesterday, too. So that's also a wild onion. They have rather broad leaves. And I was talking with Tomoko Ogawa, who's been pickling ramps. So Lana and I picked a few yesterday. And I, for my personal taste, I like to eat the bulb part. And then the stem I thought was a little woody, but the leaf is delicious. So you can have multiple uses for them. So Tomoko was pickling the ramp bulbs, and she was using a Japanese technique, which she described to me, which I hope to taste the results in a few weeks. So she took the bulbs and soaked them in salt water for 10 days. Then you rinse the salt water off of them, and then you make them like a pickled onion with a little bit of sugar and some vinegar. So this I'm looking forward to. And she told me then the tops she put in a kimchi pot. Hmm. So, but I think the tops would be good in salads or in a saute. Actually, even the bulbs, they are delightful.
And you can run across ramps in the woods. You wouldn't think that an onion sort of thing would grow in the shade, but they do. So that's where I've found them. I found them in the woods while I'm on my great morel hunts.
I can remember my mother always saying that she grew up in the country in southeast Missouri, and she was always, every time she'd see an early spring onion, she'd go, oh, that reminds me of my childhood, because the first thing that came up along the whole long lane, which I'm sure she had to walk to and from to school,
was the wild onions.
So wild onion season, let it come at us.
Sounds good. And the leaf is a really wonderful mild taste. I'm kind of infamous for being kind of brave about tasting things. So if I don't know if it's a ramp out in the woods, I just taste it. If it doesn't taste like an onion, it's not
Me too.
A ramp.
Take a teeny weeny taste.
Just a teeny weeny taste. I mean, how do we learn if we don't push our limits here? So yes, I have discovered ramp.
And you can always spit if it doesn't taste
You can always spit. I've done that too. So that's good. That's good. Well, we've learned all kinds of wonderful good things today. Remember, standing dead elm trees for morel hunting. And best of luck to everybody out there. I know morel hunting is kind of like trout fishing. No person wants to tell their secret
where
space.
Their spot is. Right?
But that's fine. Iowa is big enough. There's room for us all. So go out and look. Enjoy the woods. And open your senses to look for these things. As you go out there and look for them, say, where would I like to live if I was a mushroom? And be quiet and look down. Actually kind of
go very slowly.
Go slowly. Look under.
Subtle.
Look under.
Subtle work.
Yes. So enjoy. Enjoy the season. Enjoy morels. So this has been the Donna Lana Kitchen. And we're on Tuesdays now. So look for us on Tuesdays. And we'll be repeated again at 7 o'clock in the evening. Also, come and find us at least this coming weekend at the Main Street Farmers Market. Eat
in
local.
Downtown in Ames.
Eat local. Try new things. Visit local farmers markets and talk to a farmer. Oh, also, this coming weekend, May 24th, look for the Central Iowa Barn Dance. Come and barn dance with us. That'd be good. We're going to go out with a banjo tune. Why not? A banjo tune. This is by Sam Bartlett, a fine banjo player from Ohio, I believe. He's been up and through Ames a bit. This is a tune called Swamp Haggis. It doesn't sound like it tastes very good, but it's a great banjo tune, Swamp Haggis by Sam Bartlett. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen on this great community radio station. This is Lana Noctigal.
Donna Prisgintas.
Eat good food. Enjoy life.